Thank you. Thank you, Joe. We'll be all projecting from Joe's laptop so that the music examples go smoothly. And it's a scary world. It's a scary world out there, in particular in the US, where my co-speakers come from, because the stakes are very high. There are statutory damages, there are jury trials, and if I was a composer, a songwriter, I would look over my shoulder all the time. So what I'm trying to do in my talk today is step back from that and look at the history of copyright law, and particularly how music publishing has been organized, and see whether the world has to be that way. How did we end up in a situation where creative processes take place under fear? It's a bit unpleasant with the echo or interference. Okay. Okay, so copyright law is obviously many years longer than older than 100 years. It was a response to the creation of the printing press, and there are two different mechanisms historically which were used. One was a privilege. Essentially, if you're an author, a creator who has links to the court, you could get a privilege, and the first music privileges come already in 1511. There's an imperial privilege for Arnold Schlick in the Roman Empire in Germany. And we have in parallel a monopolistic control of what is printed and distributed through guilds. So they get a monopoly for all printed materials so that the distribution and creation of printed materials can be controlled. But the first statutory copyright law is the Statute of Anne of 1710. And I put it, some details about it up here. So music doesn't feature in the Statute of Anne. It's for books and other writings. That's the subject matter of copyright law. And it's not really the abstract work, it's an artifact. And that's a very important distinction. So it offers a protection of publishers, of printers against other printers. It's not a protection of a work against all forms of exploitation. And it's, in case law, it's not until the second half of the 18th century that the doctrine was developed that music is a work in the sense of the Statute of Anne in the UK. And what is interesting that in the case, the Bach and Longman case, the judge still held that playing the music was fine. What you couldn't do is make a reprint of the score. So that's really the foundation of music publishing, is protection of a score against reprints. So what is, as a result of that approach, is that 18th century copyright law in practice really was negotiated between publishers. And in regions of the world where jurisdiction was not unified, such as in the German Länder, where we had more than 300 jurisdictions during the 18th century, 300 jurisdictions, you had obviously a no way of controlling this kind of reprinting mechanism. So what's very interesting is that during the next 50 years, the approach to copyright completely changed. So from protecting artifacts against reprinting, we're moving to a situation where we protect abstract works which are identical, to which all forms of exploitation relate. So these forms of exploitation may be public performances, there may be abridgments, there may be arrangements, there may be translations, there may be notes you are just taking of what I'm saying. Okay? So what happened during that period is a paradigm change. And I illustrate that here. So we arrived by about 1840 in parallel in Prussia and in the UK, pretty much the same situation. So we arrive at a fairly detailed copyright provisions which derive the term of protection from the life of the author plus, and the exclusive rights include a range of derivative activities. So if we come to the current situation now, when we ask ourselves, is this a derivation of an original song, or should that be an infringement? Those questions were asked exactly at that period of time, because the way the industries were organized had to change as a result of this new conceptual approach. And therefore, we can learn a lot about our current situation by looking precisely at that period in time. So how did the cultural production, how did the cultural industries at the time respond to this paradigm change? So this is the equivalent in the UK. I'm sorry that not the whole of the slides appear here. You can see it. Okay, that's fine. So there was still an ambiguity about abridgments, about anthologies, about translations, residue of discomfort in the UK. So what I want to show you now is a concrete example of how in the setting of Berlin, because I thought that was fitting, the music publishing industry reacted to this new kind of situation. So we have here the situation where opera was popularized by making arrangement of opera in various forms. The most common one was just have a piano score, so you can, get an impression of what the opera might sound like. But there were countless other arrangements. And one of the key questions was for the publisher, if the publisher published a piano score, if somebody else published another piano score, was that an infringement? And the core issue here is one of the arrangements an infringement of the other arrangements, or do they both relate to this, what I said, the new concept of the abstract work? So at that time, the approach was, unless you copy the arrangement, you haven't made a copy. So that if both are derived from the work, there's no infringement. And there's a similar approach we find in the early copyright law about engravings. So you could take the same engraving from the same picture, but you couldn't re-engrave an engraving. Okay? So you could do this, but you couldn't do this. And what's interesting how this is reflected in the aesthetic of the time. So I give you here a quote from E.T.A. Hoffmann, again, because it fits where we are today. So because he used to be a lawyer and a public servant before he became a poet and composer, or in part in parallel, he was asked to give an opinion in one of these cases relating to the Weber operas. And it's a interesting quote. So he says the Viennese score was not a copy of the Berlin score because it was badly done. Okay, so it's, in a way, it's different than what we what comes out of our discussion now is that we're looking at, is there transformative use? Is there something new? Is what has been done with it better or different? What Hoffmann says here, if it's bad, it's fine. And in response to that opinion, Schlesinger, the Berlin publisher, changed his strategy. So he then tried to obtain privileges directly from the Crown. And the arrangement that was made was that if he specifies all possible uses he wants to make of his arrangements, then he gets exclusive rights for those. But he has to specify them. And if not within a specified period of time, he puts them on the market, everybody can do it. Okay? So this speaks very much to what we, again, will come to is, do we have here a substitution? Do we have a competition between the one arrangement and another arrangement? If there's no competition, it's fine, go for it. And so a fairly complex institutional mechanism has been evolved to deal with this problem, that we suddenly move from artifacts protected against reprints to an abstract work which is protected against all kind of exploitations. So how do we get from there to here? Well, the music publishing industry is doing really well. The annual volume of the industry is 11 billion, and that's separate from the record industry, which is another 17 billion. So it is a big industry, and the fear we have seen, which affects creative production, doesn't seem to translate in negative consequences for the industry, seen as an industry. And one of the things I think we would want to touch on in this discussion, why is that so? And why would the industry not change their practices of requiring licenses for all forms of exploitations in any form to something which is more permissive, and what kind of norms would be appropriate? So 100 years ago, it's only around 1900 really that the music publishers woke up to the potential of having all these derivative rights. Up to then, they were mostly making their money from printing scores and selling scores. So in the 1920s still, most of the British publishers encouraged free performance of musical works so that they could sell more scores, more song sheets. Okay, so there was a campaign by publisher Novello against charging for public performance because it would undermine their main business model, which was selling scores. And it's only when radio came along and gramophone became a big factor that the publisher suddenly saw that they had something to gain from switching to the new model. And that's about 70 years after the conceptual shift was made within copyright law. At this stage then, publishers thought, much is to be gained from not relying on sales, but on managing rights. So that's the key shift that took place. And once the shift to managing rights had been made, what we've seen over the last 70 years is really a concentration process, that more and more rights sit in fewer and fewer companies. And one of my propositions is that the reason why the music publishing industry is not too worried about the situation we find here. The situation that as a creator you are scared creating. It is because from a situation where you run an oligopoly of the industry, you have more to be gained from operating on the presumption that every single thing has to be licensed. So if you create this space that something doesn't have to be licensed, this would make it easier to enter the market. I think this is quite a complex argument, but I think this sits at the heart of what we, I think, see is an unreasonable situation. We have an unreasonable situation where at music colleges we have to teach students what they can't do, and they acquiring legal skills before they acquire creative skills. And I think this is not a sustainable situation. Thank you.